oriented a little bit. So this is the kind of 3D modeling software that we use for the drilling, kind of plotting up our drill holes after we've drilled them. So this contains all the historic drilling that was done back in the 80s and 90s.
So what are we looking at here? I think I got it figured out, but run your hand across the screen and show me what does each one of those mean?
Yeah, so each of these is a drill hole. So this represents the surface right here, the ground surface, and all the holes are drilled. So if we look at this kind of in plan view, it's looking straight down. I can add the drilling that we just completed. So that's these holes over here. And with that drilling, so this is what we have modeled, kind of as a preliminary model of the bend deposit.
So what does that red represent?
That red represents the copper, you know, primarily the copper and gold mineralization that we've identified to date, including, you know, from the historic drilling and incorporating our more recent drilling. So then a future steps is to kind of fill in. I mean, you can see the kind of the variability in drill density. A lot of drilling has been done in kind of the core area of the deposit. This is looking kind of inclined view, looking north. Much less drilling has been done kind of heading off to the east and that depth, as well as off to the west, kind of sparse drilling. So our kind of objectives kind of going forward are to kind of infill kind of between these holes and what we've drilled, just so that we can better define the deposit, and then to also see how far this mineralization extends at depth, both to the east and to the west.
So there's a chance that that red area grows.
Yeah, and that is, I mean, that's pretty much the objective, is to, you know, define the extents, not only the extents of the mineralization, but kind of the quality, the grade of that mineralization.
So can you point to which one on the screen is the one that we'll be looking at over on the table?
Yeah. So now I'm going to cut what we call a cross-section. So looking pretty much looking at a vertical slice through the earth. So this is looking to the west, and we will be taking a look at this hole here, which is P2504, which had one of the thickest kind of massive sulfide intervals that had been identified.
Could you run your finger across that again slowly, just so we can see which one?
It's this one right here.
I'm going to ask you to do that. Do it one more time, please. Thank you.
And so some of these other, those are historical ones, not ones that you've done?
04 is a hole that we had drilled.
Okay. Yeah, so. But some of the other holes, those... Are these all ones that we're seeing that you've done, or are there some others that are done by other groups or back to the history of the area?
Yeah, so we only drilled 6 holes on this program. I think there's been a total of, you know, roughly 60 holes drilled on the deposit to date. So this is showing the compilation of all of the drill holes. And so I guess in that context, so this was hole B7. I think this was drilled probably back in 87, and, you know, intercepted, you know, roughly 2 meters of kind of ore grade mineralization. So these holes, B25, 03, and 04, were kind of testing that same, you know, testing that interval at depth just to see how it changes. And what we found was, you know, it's showing that it's thickening at depth. And then through our subsequent drilling, it's also kind of thickening off to the east. And I've got some maps that I can show you to kind of better explain that. But yeah, so this was an impressive hole. I think it was about just over 22 meters. So, you know, you're looking at 75, 80 feet of, you know, significant ore grade mineralization.
So originally when this deposit formed, was on an ocean floor, it was a volcanic system, and that material came up, settled on the ocean floor. Over the millennia, lithified as more volcanic sediments were deposited on top of it, and then the whole thing was uplifted. So it looks like, I always say, it kind of looks like a piece of bologna in a bologna sandwich. That's what that tabular red thing is.
Yeah, okay. And that's, you know, and Steve is right. I mean, these things do form. I mean, they are currently forming right now on the ocean floor in different kind of geologic settings. You've probably seen on like the Discovery Channel those black smoker pipes that they've found kind of with deep sea exploration. Those are actually modern day VMS systems that are forming. So what happens is there's hot hydrothermal fluids kind of percolating through the crust, and they make their way up, shoot out those vents, and their mineral-laden fluids, as they hit that cold water, those minerals fall out, so you get this kind of downfall of sulfide mineralization with copper and zinc and precious metals. And so, you know, back 1.8 billion years ago, you know, this surface right here does actually represent, you know, what that paleo seafloor looked like at that time. And as far as for us kind of vectoring into mineralization, you know, we look at the geology very closely to kind of put, you know, re-piece together that kind of a stratigraphy and kind of see where we are. I mean, we're looking for that paleo seafloor horizon, and that's where the mineralization is.
Cool. And so then from there,
This is a plan view, so looking straight down. These are the historic drill holes, our more recent drilling. The ore body is kind of sitting there semi-vertically, probably dipping, you know, roughly 80 degrees to the south.
Would you take your left hand and just kind of point out a few things on the screen again, please?
All right, so these are showing, you know, the historic drilling on the site, with this area right here representing the area that we drilled this past summer, completing six holes, connecting up a lot of the historic mineralization that was identified, as well as a few historic step-out holes that had identified additional mineralization, so we pretty much showed the continuity between the core deposit and this kind of extension to the east. And we can incline that, kind of looking more to the west.
Basically, keep doing that for
the surface.
So this area of Wisconsin has a significant amount of overburden. So there's roughly kind of 100 to 120 feet vertical of unconsolidated glacial material. So this surface right here represents, you know, the Precambrian, you know, bedrock surface, which is overlain by that 100 feet of sand and gravel.
Mm-hmm. So would we compare this to, like, you know, the UP where, you know, Native peoples found copper coming to the surface? Was that just different levels of uplift that creates that contrast where they could have surface mines?
Well, it's really just the glaciology of the area. So the, you know, I mean, if you think of kind of the Canadian Shield, you go up there, there's very little overburden because that was kind of the area, you know, down here in Wisconsin, we're kind of reaching the end of the glaciation. So all that material that was ground up way up north was pushed down to the south. And that's what, you know, we're seeing here is that those deposits of glacial material. So you get up into the UP, there's, you know, it's variable. It's very variable up there. I mean, you can go up there and, you know, you've got big, you know, giant outcrops, you know, and kind of knobs and whatnot, mixed in with, you know, sand plains and areas where there was glacial deposition. You get down here into Wisconsin and, you know, that glacial overburden is significant. And actually I was kind of talking, we had a group from UW-Eau Claire here, and we were out at site and we were talking about the overburden. And it's like, if that overburden wasn't here, northern Wisconsin would probably have been built on mining. Because they would have discovered those back in the you know, early 1900s. And
the copper mines up in Michigan,
so is it just the process was different of how it was created? I guess it's that similar to like gold veins or something.
You could say that,
like a load versus it being distributed.
Yep, okay. It was more magmatic oriented, if you will, that copper, whereas this is volcanic, you know, so it's a little different, you know, origin to the metal.
Yeah, it was more of a soft science instead of a hard science, more political science instead of...
But, all right, so here we're looking, again, at plan. This is a geologic map. These kind of lighter gray holes are the historic drilling. These darker, more bold holes are the drill holes that we just drilled this year. Kind of these red intercepts here represent the mineralization that was encountered in all of those holes. So basically the six holes that we drilled were drilled, you know, kind of roughly on two separate sections about 50 meters apart. And that's kind of how, when you're kind of methodically trying to define a deposit, you know, you're pretty much trying to hit it at a kind of regular spacing, kind of a long strike and down dip of it to really map, be able to map out, you know, where it is and what it looks like. So these represent the two cross sections. So this blue line here, kind of vertical slice, and this blue line here, vertical slice through the earth. Mineralized zone is represented by this red unit. This is B2504 here, so this is the hole that we have laid out here. And then also over there we have B2506, which was the deepest hole that we drilled. And, you know, I guess kind of what we're seeing, and this is kind of the nature of exploration. We had actually, this drill program, we had actually intended to drill three other holes kind of higher up in the, you know, higher up dip. But these first two holes that we drilled, mineralization was very kind of marginal and weak. We drilled this undercut. We could tell that the mineralized section was improving. You know, the alteration, the grade, the thickness of the mineralization was improving. So we ended up kind of refocusing our efforts and decided that deeper and off to the east was better. So these different colors on these cross sections represent different lithologies. And we have, you know, typical in kind of ore, you know, deposit type geology, we have what is called a hanging wall and a foot wall. And those are kind of old terms, really, for just what's above you and what's below you. I mean, this is a stratigraphic deposit, so the ore mineralization is this red here, as well as the purple, and, you know, we get kind of pervasive mineralization through this lighter purple as well. So this is kind of what we call the mineralized series. Everything out of there, outside of that, both above and below it, within the hanging wall up here and footwall here, is kind of benign, just host rock, just a series of, you know, volcanic and volcanoclastic rocks that were overlain on the deposit, completely unrelated to the mineralizing event.
What was the first one?
Yep. And so this is a plan map, so we're looking straight down, looking at the historic drill holes here in kind of this lighter gray. The more bold holes are the holes that we drilled this past summer. And these red intervals represent mineralized intervals within all of those drill holes. So, and then back to those cross sections. These blue lines represent those vertical slices. You know, this one being this one here, and this one being this one here. And again, just kind of showing that through the drilling that we did this summer, you know, we just kind of identified a thickening of mineralization at depth and going off to the east, which actually on this long section. So now a long section, this is kind of a pseudo vertical look, but like head on to the deposit. So looking at that deposit as just a flat plane, and all these points on here represent the pierce points where those drill holes intercepted that mineralized horizon. This orange here represents kind of the historic extents of kind of the core deposit area. This orange outline here represents a few kind of far-spaced holes where they had intercepted mineralization, kind of down plunge to the east of the core deposit. And, you know, these labeled holes here are the six holes that we drilled this past summer, really trying to figure out the continuity between that core historic deposit and these step-out holes that were drilled previously. These contours here show the thickness, kind of the true thickness of that mineralized section. So you can see that, you know, some of the, you know, the thickest area in the core deposit is roughly 22 meters. And I can't remember exactly what hole that was, but D2504, you know, also represents one of the thickest intercepts that have been recorded on the deposit to date. And by creating these plots, we can kind of figure out where we think that kind of main mineralized section of the deposit is going. So our future drilling will be stepping out, you know, on the holes that we drilled here to really define kind of the trend of that mineralization and, you know, see how far it goes. Then we could probably look at some core. So I kind of discussed the hanging wall, kind of, you know, relatively unrelated volcanic rocks that were just, you know, piled on top of that mineralized section. So that's kind of what we're looking at here. You know, it's kind of variable textures, kind of going from, you know, volcanoclastic to volcanoclastic sediments, tufts, a few kind of coarser grain lapilli tufts.
And this is what most people just refer to as bedrock?
Yeah, well, I mean, bedrock can be bedrock can be anything.
But up here, if someone's within, trying to drill a well, or they hit bedrock, they're hitting this.
In this area, anyways, kind of throughout this volcanic belt, you're going to see some fashion of volcanoclastic rocks and or volcanically related intrusive rocks. So this here, this series of finely bedded argillites and kind of cherty sediments, this really represents the very last phase of the mineralized section of rocks. So you're getting this buildup of sulfide mineralization on the seafloor. As that system starts shutting down, you just start getting regular kind of sedimentation of fine grain sediments and kind of some chemical exhalative rocks. But yeah, this pretty much represents the top of the mineralized section. And as you move down, obviously there's a very stark contrast between the unmineralized rock and the heavy sulfide content within the massive to semi-massive sulfide section. And in here, a lot of this is dominated by pyrite. You kind of have to have a bit of an eye for it, but this is some pretty gaudy mineralization. You can tell the difference between the color of those two sulfides, this being pyrite, pyrite dominant here, whereas this is pretty much pure chalcopyrite. Chalcopyrite would be the copper sulfide that hosts the copper within the deposit.
So growing up,
everyone told me that pyrite was called fool's gold.
Yep.
Because it was worthless, it looked like gold.
Yep.
Is it still that today, or does it have any value?
The pyrite in itself does host some of the gold mineralization. So, there is gold associated with that. It's also, the host, in these types of deposits, you have a lot of sulfur within those hydrothermal fluids, and that sulfur can either, will attach to iron, and it'll attach to copper, it'll attach to zinc. So, all these deposits are pyrite hosted with variable quantities of whatever the ore mineral is, whether it's chalcopyrite, copper, sphalerite, zinc, galena, lead.
Would you point out the difference between the two pieces again?
Yeah, so this is pyrite dominant. There is some fine-grained chalcopyrite kind of interstitially throughout there, but this more gold-looking mineral is the chalcopyrite, which is the copper sulfide. A thick section. I think it was 22-23 meters of massive sulfide mineralization. You can see that there's kind of variable sulfide quantities throughout there, but it was also had significant gold mineralization in it. And if you kind of take a close look, you'd already looked at this, but the visible gold within, I think, it was about roughly 2 meters, probably averaging about a third of an ounce per ton, which is extremely, extremely high grade material. I don't know if you can see that gold in there, but so within those red circles, that's just
tilted more towards me.
Towards me and just keep it there for a sec.
So that's the exciting stuff to see.
Well, it's exciting to see, and it's very rare. Even in most gold deposits, you're not going to actually see the gold. It's pretty rare for it to be in quantities great enough where it's what we call visible gold. Usually it's just identified based on, you know, the host mineralization or alteration, and you're not going to know it's there until you get the analysis back. So it's always, as an exploration geologist, it's always exciting to see it in the core.
So in like old-fashioned terms, you'd say it's struck gold?
Yeah, say that.
That's going to be the lead quote to the story.
Yeah.
Gold Rush and Taylor Company.
Yeah, well, I think when we were working on the reef deposit back in 2010, I think the local paper had an article, and the title was, "There's Gold Up in Them There Hills."
So how far down is, how many feet down is that section we were just looking at, where'd it go?
Yeah, so I guess I could just kind of explain. So the way that you read these core boxes, you really read them like a book if they're flipped this way. So this represents the top of the hole, this represents the bottom of the hole, you know, reading it left to right. These core blocks are placed in here by the drillers. So the drillers drill in 10-foot intervals. They have 10-foot tooling. So they'll drill down 10 feet, pull up the rock. After each time they pull it up, they put a block so that you know where you are in the hole. So these are all the depths in meters going down.
So
this section right here was roughly 275 to 290 meters down hole. And so these holes are drilled at an angle, so that doesn't represent your vertical depth. That's just your down hole depth. I would assume vertically we're probably maybe 200 to 225 meters vertically below the surface. And?
So about 700 feet down. Yeah. Because
yep.
Meter is roughly 3 feet.
Yeah. Yep. So no one's getting a shovel out.
Yeah, right. Yep.
No. You're not even going to get down to bedrock with a shovel because it's ways down there. Yeah, so this represents the bottom of that massive sulfide, kind of the main mineralization. Underlying that, you have what we call the quartz crystal tuff unit, which kind of shows just kind of classic alteration associated with these deposits. You'll kind of notice that this has kind of a dark, almost kind of a bluish tint to it that's caused by chlorite, which is, you know, typical for the footwall immediately underlying your massive sulfide mineralization. And as you move down, it becomes more gray. You're getting out of that kind of chlorite alteration into your quartz sericite alteration, which really just kind of means you're moving further away from that main kind of mineralized horizon.
So when you're looking at this stretch in here, obviously the color alone, when you know what you're looking for, will tell you this is the area to focus on. After that, is it all analysis at the lab that's going to tell you the specifics?
Well, I guess the order of operations, the flow of work. So the core comes from the rig. The drillers bring it at the end of each shift. We lay it out here. We have a number of geotechs that do different measurements. They'll mark, you know, they'll convert the blocks. The drillers are drilling in feet. We're logging everything in meters. They'll convert the blocks. They'll put the meter marks on the core. They'll do some structural, you know, rock quality measurements, which we call our QD. then the geologist comes in, and we, you know, we log it in pretty finite detail, you know, through the hanging wall into the mineralized section. And obviously, you know, the ore horizon is kind of based on mineralogy, the minerals that we're seeing, you know, the appearance of, you know, minerals of economic interest, you know, sulfide minerals, etc. So we take all those notes based on what we're seeing. We decide what needs to be sampled, which has, you know, what we want to see, you know, whether, you know, what the metal content of that rock is. So, I mean, if you noticed up at the top of what I showed you here, that core was not even cut in half, so it's uninteresting rock. We didn't even send it out for analysis. But everything that we're interested in, we mark out for sampling. We take photos of every box of core, then it goes to the core cutters who cut it in half, and then they sample it. We send those off to the lab for analysis.
Mike, I don't know if you want to get some
I can play geologist for a day.
Well, they're good looking rocks.
Are you just videoing or recording voice too?
All of the above.
Yeah. Okay. The audio is there, we probably won't need it. So, okay.
So what's this right there?
Cool. Yeah. All right. So you can kind of see. I mean, it's probably dominated by pyrite.
Yeah.
But you can definitely see there's that patch in there.
Yeah.
And through there, there's a nice little wisp of kind of chalcopyrite rich mineral volcanic fragment. So the way that these things form is actually like if you look at some of the modern day analogies,
yeah.
I mean those chimneys can be like 30, 40 feet, 50 feet tall,
yeah. Yeah.
But they're constantly being built, but they're also kind of breaking and slumping and sloughing. Meanwhile, you've got adjacent volcanic activity.
So you've got something right there.
Yeah.
Hold that for a second, please. Could you bring it up a little higher like you had it?
Tilt it more towards you?
Yeah, please.
Well, for the mineralized rock, it would be, I mean, we refer to it as massive to semi-massive sulfide.
Okay.
And that's all pretty much just based on the sulfide content. Like, you know, roughly, you know, 35 to 65% sulfide is typically semi-massive. Anything above that, you would refer to as massive sulfide.
You said underneath was quartz.
Yeah, and this is a quartz crystal tuff, which is kind of a classic rock to be that hosts these deposits.
And then what would you call the stuff on top?
And the stuff on top is really just kind of volcanic sediments and volcanoclastic rocks.
So if someone wanted to make a nice kitchen countertop with this, would it be good material? Or?
Probably not. Okay. I think just based on the fractures within there for those types of quarries, they're looking for rock that has, you know, very few fractures in it, which is actually kind of a rare thing to find. You can make some rolling pins out of that.
Let's get you to say and spell your name and give your title just so we have it correct on tape.
All right, Eric Quigley, it's E-R-I-C-Q-U-I-G-L-E-Y, and I'm the Director of Exploration for Greenlight.
Great, thank you.
3D software makes it kind of easier, but you don't get anything more out of it than they used to get back in the old days. But, so these represent the first two holes that we had drilled, and I had kind of made a point that we kind of adjusted our... We drilled this undercut immediately after that, still kind of underwhelming, but definitely you can see a thickening of that crystal tuff unit underlying it, two lenses of massive sulfide that were very, very small and kind of insignificant, but kind of based on seafloor topography, you know, this mineralization probably forms in kind of little depressions and kind of little kind of miniature basins. So there can be a lot of variability to that. So, you know, at some point in every, you know, the understanding of every deposit, you go out and you start drilling to miss,
yeah.
You know, really just confirming that we get deeper and deeper. You know, does it keep getting bigger, or is it going to kind of, you know, pinch out at depth? I mean, it will at some point. So that'll be our MO for the next round of drilling.
In January, are we over here or are we up here?
Well, we're down here. It's not where it isn't. I mean, we'll find out where it isn't, but right now it's to use the information that we have available to try to follow this for as far as we can.
And how long does it take to drill a hole?
Yeah, let's see. These deeper holes took, you know, two, maybe three rigs out there to just get it done.
It's a good chunk of time. I hope the weather holds.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's good and cold.
Yeah, we'll keep.
But that's the main issue.
Inch and a half, 2 inches of rain.
I think we're done with what we need to bother you for, so we can take that back. Thank you for giving us a tour. That was actually really, really helpful for someone who doesn't know that much about it. It was fascinating.
Drilling a hole in January could be nearly a 2-week project.
Mm-hmm.
When would be the ideal window for us to come up and be able to observe part of that?
Well, as we get closer to the date, I'll just reach out to you.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, you know, once we get about 2 weeks into it, everything's up and running and smoothed out, then we can get you back up here.
Okay.
But we'll try to give you enough advance notice.
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm trying to visualize, like, so I'm assuming we turn big machines, you get to see
yeah.
a pipe, and then you see something come up,
yeah.
and hopefully it's a section that's...
Yeah, you're going to see, like, a trailer out there with a big, like, drill mast sticking up at an angle,
okay.
and on it will be enclosed because it's going to be cold.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see some vehicles with pipe on it, that type of stuff, and drilling products. Mud that night, and then you'll see a hole in the ground that's lined where the same as a water well. You know, it's just that the tower is at an angle, but the drilling materials and stuff like that are all basically the same, with the exception of what you use to core the rock. That's different. So,
continuous process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say, you know, those holes take about a week to drill. And kind of the target is to probably get them all logged, cut, sampled, and shipped out within 10 days of completing the hole. It's kind of an estimate.
And then you're also going to do another town hall type event before
in January, you think?
Probably. Yeah. Everybody wanted to see the rocks. But it was good, you know. People were, you know, as here in Wisconsin, you know, like for Cranbrook, you know, that was a hot button issue in the state. And you go to a town meeting or a public event, and
all right. So I guess give me a sense of what we're looking at here and how it looks today versus what it might have looked like
Sure.
a couple months ago.
Sure. So this is the location of our drill program from that we completed between July and the end of August this past year, so 2025. And what we're standing on right here is the access road that comes into the first drill site. You see those orange stakes sticking up out of the ground? That's where we completed the first two drill holes. And the site's been reclaimed. It's been revegetated. Behind those stakes is where the sump was excavated to contain the drill cuttings. And when we're done with that, done with the entire drill program, those drill cuttings are mixed with cement and then it's buried. All of the activities that we conducted in here were done under the permits and authorization from the Wisconsin DNR and the U.S. Forest Service. And they regulated the access road. They regulated how we managed the drill cuttings, the types of materials that we used in the drill program. And then they regulate how we have to reclaim the site. So all of our work that we've done in here is financially assured, meaning it's bonded with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, so that we're held accountable for the reclamation and the abandonment of the holes. The DNR will be back out here over the course of the next year to confirm that the vegetation has taken root, it's healthy, it's stable, and they'll have to do that before we get our financial assurance back.
So I know one of the there are people that are opposed to mining, period. But there are other people just have concerns that all these exploratory drillings, going deep in the Earth's surface, what are you pumping in there? What does this prove to them? Or what would you want them to be able to see here?
Well, a couple things. First of all, the type of drilling that we're doing is really no different than what's done for domestic residences when they're drilling a water well. The only thing that's really different is that we're going deeper, and when we get into the bedrock, we're coring that. But the drill materials and the types of technology that we use are very similar to what's done in the water well industry or other engineering applications all across the state. So it's a very safe process and it's highly regulated. The other thing that I think is important for the public is the amount of land that we disturb here is actually quite small. The road that we came in on, we didn't take out any big trees. Any tree that we did take out had to be authorized by the U.S. Forest Service, so we're talking small diameter type trees. And the area disturbance is pretty small. We're talking about a drill area here that's maybe 50 by 75 feet wide and a 10-foot wide, 15-foot wide access trail coming in here. So it's pretty limited disturbance for doing the drilling.
And so future exploratory holes will be off in that direction?
Well, future holes will be, some will be off in that direction. We'll probably have some on the other side of the road as well. So what we're looking to do is place those holes in areas to confirm either past drilling data or in areas where the deposit hasn't been fully explored.
So we're talking, how far down are we standing over what you're hoping is there?
So the bedrock here is about is covered by about 100 to maybe 125, 150 feet of glacial overburden. So that's a lot of sand and gravel and silts and stuff like that. And the mineralization is within that bedrock. And that mineralization could go down maybe 1,500 feet from the bedrock surface. We don't exactly know the extent of all that. Could be a little shallower, could be a little deeper. But that's the type of depths that we're talking about.
I mean, it's interesting to think that most people could walk out here and just go for a walk in the woods and never realize what's underneath their feet.
That's right. It's kind of interesting. And the other thing, too, is people could walk through this area, and but for the stakes that we have sticking up out of the ground, they probably wouldn't know that there was drilling that was conducted here. Just on the other side of the road, we can take you to a drill site that was drilled probably 20 years ago or so. And so it's been reclaimed and stuff like that. And if you didn't know that there was a drill hole that was done there, you wouldn't know that anybody was there.
So is the concern that like these holes, that like, stuff could come get in or stuff comes out? Or what is the environmental concern that, I mean, you guys obviously have to take care of, but what are the larger issues with that?
Well, I think some of the concerns that we've heard from the public are the types of drilling materials that we're using. And what we've always told the public is any kind of drilling material that we use, like bentonite or anything like that, to mix the mud to flush the cuttings up out of the hole, all of those products that we used are on an approved DNR list of products that can be used for any kind of drilling in the state, not just for exploration drilling. It could be for construction purposes or if someone's doing a scientific study. They would be regulated to use the same types of products. The other thing that people tend to be concerned about is what happens to the hole once you're done with it. And again, what we are obligated to do under the permits is if we've got a 1,500-foot drill hole, we have to abandon that, and that means we have to stick a pipe down to the bottom of the hole and pump cement grout from the bottom of the hole all the way up to the top and then pull that drill casing out so the whole thing is cemented up. And that's the same type of procedure that's required for anybody that's doing any kind of drilling, again, for exploration purposes or scientific research, etc.
It's a lot of concrete.
It's a lot of concrete, but it's very standard in the industry. So that's the way the practice works today.
Okay. And just from the computer graphing that we saw, like, there's holes all over around here, right? Like, this, it's not just right here.
That's correct. Yeah, so the site that we're drilling has previously been explored going back to the mid-1980s. And so, as we saw earlier in the core shed, we've got all that exploration core from those previous drill programs. So you're right. If you walk through the area, there's literally been, you know, 50 to 75 drill holes that have been drilled through this area already. And again, if you didn't know about it, you wouldn't know that any of that was done in this area.
And there's no evidence that that's caused any environmental damage or sulfides? Yeah, there's
no evidence that it's caused any damage. I've been in the industry for 35 years, and, you know, understandably, people have concerns about impacts to water during a mining operation, and that's a different ballgame. But for exploration purposes, I'm not aware of any exploration program that's ever caused any harm to either groundwater or surface water.
So when you're doing the community outreach, is there, do you draw a distinction between exploration and mining? Because obviously one hopefully leads to the other. But if people's concerns are about what a mine looks like versus exploration, are you trying to like separate those out?
Yeah, that's a very good question. You're exactly right. That's exactly how we talk to the public about it is, you know, we're in the exploration stage now. So at this site, obviously we would hope that the drilling data shows that there could be a mine here someday, but we don't have an answer to that question yet. That's going to require more drilling. So there's certain set of regulations that we operate under for exploration. Just because we do exploration at a site doesn't mean there's necessarily going to be a mine there. And if there does end up being a mine there, that doesn't mean there's going to be a mine here next year. We've got to do a lot of exploration work. And then we've got to do a lot of engineering analysis and environmental studies to come up with what we think is a viable, permittable mine plan. And then we would start the permitting process. So that's probably 4 to 5 years down the road.
How do you respond to people who say, well, I will oppose a mine, so why should I be okay with you? Like, I'd rather not know that whether it's worth looking here or not.
Well, there's certainly, as we've met with the public, we've seen kind of people in kind of three different camps, if you will. One, there's obviously going to be a group that's very supportive. There's going to be some folks that are kind of in the middle wanting to learn more information. And then there's a small group that I would say that just are, you know, I don't want it in my backyard. We recognize that there's those different public perceptions out there. What we've told people is that in our public meetings is we want to hear from everybody, and we want to know what their questions are, whether they're for or they've got concerns. We will attempt to answer their questions as best we can based on the information that we have now. And as we continue doing exploration, we continue doing these engineering studies and looking at alternatives, we want to take all that public input into account and share the results of that with the public as we progressively go through this process.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else you want to add just immediately on the area or anything around here?
I think that's good.
Okay. Yeah. So we're able to walk through here, right?
Yep. Helps people like Eric then plan drill programs.
Mm-hmm. Do I have to be in there?
You don't have to be, no.
You're on your own, Chief.
Okay, go ahead.
So this is one of our exploration boreholes. This yellow steel pipe that you see sticking up out of the ground is the casing that goes down through the overburden into the bedrock. And this one has not yet been completely abandoned by us. We have a steel plate on the top of it that's welded so that nobody can get into it. And we haven't abandoned this one yet because we want to use it for doing what's called downhole borehole geophysics, where we run equipment down into the borehole. It's basically, think of it as like a radar beam that goes out into the rock, and it gives you a map of the mineralization around the borehole. So it helps the geologists interpret the exploration data from the core and plan future boreholes in this area to help delineate the ore body.
If this is 3 and 4, where's Is it two holes here, or why am I not seeing a second hole?
So three has been abandoned.
Okay, so so that back orange stake represents four that hasn't been abandoned because the yellow's still there.
Right.
Yeah.
So this one goes with this stake, and the other one that's been abandoned, that was right there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever think of coming up with a better term than abandoned? It sounds so...
That's a that's right in the code.
That's literally...
Yeah, so... Yeah, it's called borehole abandonment.
Oh, abandoned in the woods.
It's yeah.
So sad.
Yeah. So you do the same thing like, if an industrial site, say a landfill or something like that, has monitoring wells and they expand the landfill, then they have to abandon those monitoring wells. And it's same type of process, except they're shallower. Mm. So we're going through the same process here, except it's deeper.
No, I mean, I showed you that 3D model.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, basically I'm looking at that plane and I'm finding points along that plane that I want to test.
Mm-hmm.
And then you draw a line up to the surface and say, okay, this is the drill site. But then you come out into the woods, and that's what Jill is doing out here right now. You know, I've made all those drill sites that we want to utilize. So she's out there staking them. We'll come in and we'll take a look and be like, well, I'm not going to put it right there in the middle of those big trees there. We can move it over to kind of avoid disturbances. We'll be looking at access.
So you can use get around evidence on the woods. Ground to...
They can bend quite a bit, especially when you're targeting stuff deep. It becomes kind of problematic to account.
The rock and the pipe?
There's kind of a natural deviation with, just the direction that the rods are spinning. Mm-hmm. They tend to flatten out and head off to the right, but then that can also be affected by the geology that's encountered. So installed out here. When was this? When were they put in?
It was a few years ago by the Wisconsin Geologic Natural History Survey.
Okay. Yep.
Then the USGS has a gauging station on the river right up by the bridge there. So, they've already started doing some data collection at the request, I think it was Glyphwick maybe. So it's a good question. We had a delegation of Native Americans come out to the site probably 2 weeks into the drilling program. And they were from the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin, the Lakota Ray, and I thought there was maybe one person from the Lac du Flambeau. Recognize we're in ceded territories here, so we'd like to learn more about their concerns, and we'd like to have the opportunity to show them what we're doing to protect things as we do the drilling programs. We view them as an important community for us to talk to. It's probably been an area that's been a little lacking in the industry historically, because normally companies won't start talking to the tribes until they get to the permitting process for the mine. So what we told them is looking at what their needs are and seeing if we can work with them to help address some of those. We also recognize what their initial position is going to be, but we do share some things in common, which is, we all live in this great country on this great land. We do have local issues that we need to address. Environment, we need to be talking more. So that's what we're hoping to do.
Because one of the issues with the Taconite Mine was, that was on reservation land and directly into their waters and the Bad River especially.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to be as applicable here, or am I overlooking something?
Well, yeah, so the Taconite project, was upstream of the Bad River Reservation, but all of that water that drained through it went right through the reservation. Obviously, that was going to be a hot-button issue. Here, we don't have any Native American reservations immediately downstream or downstream any point. But that doesn't mean there aren't cultural interests in the area, harm any of those interests.
Ho-Chunk are interesting. Their interests pop up just about everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Newer reporters is Erica Aisi. I don't know if I'd be able to tell if they're like Ash from the White Ash.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would either.
I know there's something you can do to count the leaves, the leaves form on the branch or something, but I've never taken the time to bother to learn the difference.
There's a local kind of environmental group called Friends of the Yellow River that's formed. They were out here quite a bit. They've been to our town hall meetings. We've also done just one-on-one meetings with them. But they have heard in February, then we did a meeting with the County Mining Committee, and they were both open to the public. When we met with the County Mining Committee, there were some public people sitting in there, and one of their members came up, introduced themselves, said they're from Friends of the Yellow River, and said, okay, let's talk. So,
is there any organized opposition? Because everything I've heard is just like random.
Yeah, it's not.
Of course, it's never the locals, it sounds.
Yeah. Haven't seen kind of organized opposition like I'm used to seeing on other projects. So it's mainly been, I would call them local interest groups, concerned citizen groups. There's obviously the bigger kind of statewide focused on Flambeau. And that goes back to the 1980s. But they're still there. Some of them might be just kind of aging out, you know, because people get older like me.
Yeah, it was interesting when the mining bill came up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Covered that story. His group was like, his job's tomorrow, and the other group was like, the mines immediately.
Yeah, yeah, it's, yep.
Then nothing happened.
Well, there's not much in this industry that's fast.
Yeah.
It's a long process.
That's why this is fascinating timing for me, just to pay attention to the gubernatorial election next year.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I've got Tiffany, I'm going to interview him in early December. I'm going to have him come in, and I'll probably throw a question in here just
sure.
to put it for the hell of it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't actually mean anything different. Yeah. Are there Wisconsin companies able to do this, or do you have to go out of state?
I don't think there's any real exploration-focused drilling companies out there. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of geotechnical-type drilling companies out there. So as far as exploration, kind of on a regional basis, we really just have Taffnite, who is the group that we had used, and then Timberline, and they're both based out of
closed shop.
Just not enough work?
Yeah. No. And it was elsewhere, so they all kind of moved elsewhere. Yeah.
So the skills to run that don't translate to anything else that they could do in between those? They're just too specific?
They could, I think if you can do it.
Going deeper, it does take some experience kind of doing that. And I think just a lot of that geotechnical drilling is kind of 5 days a week,
yeah.
9 to 5. Mm-hmm. There's exploration drillers that are around the clock, 12-hour shifts. Typically have guys down there for a few weeks. in, even outside, outside of Wisconsin, the exploration industry is kind of, it's got its ups and downs. So,
one of the things they told us was that the mine's closed, but now, not that one, but a different one's going to reopen because they found cobalt or chromium or another precious metal that they didn't realize was under. But they said that, that was going to be a, all of a sudden these went from like a crappy tourist attraction to like, you know, huge industry. That was what they opened anyway.
I had not heard that. And it's horrific conditions they work in. And that's where a lot, like what Eric was saying before, it's where a lot of this stuff comes from. And we can do it. If we can, I always say, if we can design a satellite with a, you know, an exotic telescope on it to put it out in orbit beyond the moon, to look into the farthest reaches of space, we can do it. It's just applying good engineering practice. That's what we got to do. And then we don't need to be, you know, getting our metals from these kind of pretty, you know, operations that use child labor.
Well,
you know, and that's real.
Talking about comparisons like the blood diamond thing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's what the drill set looked like after we pulled all the equipment off of it. Hand grading. Certified weed seed for the DNR, say approved.
Special for forests.
I call this the U.S. Forest Service Boutique Seed Mix. So there's a bunch. There's a bunch of stuff in there.
Right.
Milkweed, black-eyed Susan.
Oh, it's almost a prairie mix, anyway.
Yeah, so, okay. And then obviously cover crop.
Yeah.
There's actually a little bridge going across here.